Hello? Who? Hobby Lobby? It's for you, ladies and gentlemen. It's for you. Hobby Lobby, conducted by the Dean of Hobbyists, the originator of Hobby Lobby, Dave Elliott.
Thank you, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Hobby Lobby. Well, we have many exciting guests on Hobby Lobby tonight, and you're going to meet the first one, Arthur Williamson, just as soon as we hear a short message from our sponsor.
Youngstown, Ohio gives us our first hobbyist tonight. He is Arthur Williamson, formerly a piano salesman. Mr. Williamson, what's your hobby?
Music.
Well, now, there's nothing unusual about music as a hobby.
But, Dave, I play the piano.
Well, no, that's not unusual either.
Oh, yes, it is.
Unusual for a man to play the piano? How? Why?
8 years ago, I was the foreman of a crew of men who trimmed trees for telephone and electric wires. In my spare time, I studied music.
But you're bound to get that music in, aren't you?
There's a reason. One night after delivering a payroll to Pittsburgh, I started back in my car.
You were alone?
Yes. I hadn't driven more than 10 miles out of Pittsburgh when a car flagged me down. The two men in the car that stopped me took my money, clothing, car, and left me on the highway to die. It was 22 degrees below zero.
Well, no, couldn't you call for help?
Well, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and besides, I was unconscious. 6 hours later, I'm told that I stumbled into a farmhouse, and they thought I was drunk. They directed me to a foundry 1,000 yards away.
Well, what did you do?
I started for the foundry, but fell in my tracks. The farm folk, at least, realizing the fix I was in, took me in their home.
Well, that's a very interesting story, Mr. Williamson. But what has that to do with music being your hobby?
Everything. I was frozen so badly my fingers and toes had to be amputated. And when I was coming out of the anesthetic, I overheard my mother and the doctor talking. The doctor told her I'd be able to do everything I did before except play the piano. I love music, and I hated to hear those words. And so as soon as my health permitted it, I took up my hobby, piano playing.
You took up piano playing without fingers?
Yes. So far as I know, I'm the world's only fingerless piano.
Well, now, before we hear you play a fingerless piano solo, what do you intend doing with your hobby, Arthur?
I'd like to turn my hobby into my profession.
Well, here's hoping that tonight's broadcast will help you do it. And now, let's hear one of your fingerless piano solos.
The International Building, here at Radio City, there's one of the most unusual collections to be found in this country. The owner of it is Louis Eisenstein, importer and cutter of diamonds of the firm of Eisenstein Warnock & Sons, Incorporated. Tell me, Lou, what is your hobby?
I collect antique watches.
Yes, and right here in this studio, this very minute, is your entire collection of antique watches valued at $100,000 and here under armed guard. Lou, a couple of weeks ago, Walter Nelson was on Hobby Lobby, and he spent an imaginary 100 years trying to sell me a bicycle, and I wasn't a very good customer either. See if you can spend an imaginary 100 years selling me a watch.
100 years? The place for the watch was made over 425 years ago, about 1510.
That was about 20 years after Columbus discovered America.
Yes.
Well, all right, I'll be the customer and you be the watch salesman 425 years ago.
All right.
Now, I'm coming into your store.
If it's 425 years ago, I haven't a store. I'm the village blacksmith.
Oh, I don't want to shoe a horse. I want to buy a watch.
Well, the place watchmakers or blacksmiths or locksmiths. So come into my blacksmith shop and let's start.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Blacksmith. I'd like to buy a watch.
I don't want to delve into your personal affairs, sir, but are you a member of royalty or an extremely wealthy man?
What difference does that make?
Well, unless you are, you can't afford to buy one. All portable timekeepers are made on order, and they're very expensive.
Oh. Well, what's your cheapest?
I can make one in an iron or silver case for $400 or $500. It'll be ready for you in 3 years.
All right, it's 3 years later and I'm back. Is my watch ready?
Here it is. It weighs 2 pounds.
Oh, that looks very, very nice. That's about the size of an ostrich egg. Does it keep good time?
Excellent. It's within 2 hours of being right every minute.
Colossal. All right, now the scene has changed. It's a few hundred years later. Instead of 1510, it's 1780. Watches have improved considerably by this time, haven't they?
Yes. Instead of only one hand, like the watches used to have, this one has three.
My. Three? A watch only needs one. Anybody knows that. The hour hand.
Yes, but I thought you'd like something fancy, so I put a minute hand on it.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can see where that might help. What's the third hand for? That one sticking up at the top?
That's a calendar hand. Tells you what day of the month it is.
Is that a fact?
Yes, and it's a repeater, too.
A repeater? Well, what do you mean by repeater?
Well, suppose it's nighttime, and you want to know what time it is. With this one, you can tell time at night without lighting a candle.
How's that?
You press this little knob, and whatever time it is, the watch rings out the hour for you. Listen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1/4, 2/4. About 8:30. Well, listen, Lou, coming out of your shop and back to reality, that watch that just struck off the hour and the half hour, when was it made?
About 1750, and it works as well today as the day it was made.
Well, thank you, Mr. Eisenstein, for lobbying for a hobby that takes up 425 years of time. John B. McLaughlin is an instructor in economics at the Ashland Senior High School in Ashland, Kentucky. He had to wait for Christmas vacation to accept our invitation to lobby for his hobby. Mr. McLaughlin, what is your hobby?
Collecting odd and unusual facts. For example, did you ever hear of a pig that thought he was a dog?
A pig that thought he was a dog? Well, is there such an animal?
Yes, down in Henderson, Kentucky. You see, the pig was raised with 7 Eskimo Spitz pups. And the pups and the pig regard themselves as brothers and sisters. Recently, when the pig was taken out of the dog kennel and placed with other pigs, he turned his nose up and refused to eat. He was taken back to the kennel, and he's been leading a dog's life ever since.
And you'll vouch for the authenticity of every odd fact you tell about tonight?
Yes, I can give my source of information on every statement made. And these sources are not cartoons or newspaper columns.
Well, how about some more odd facts, then?
The Indians who sold Manhattan Island to Peter Minuit for some firewater and $24 worth of trinkets were smart boys.
Smart boys? Well, how do you make that out?
They didn't own it. They were the Canarsies and Montauks and Rockaway tribes from Long Island, just in town for a visit.
Yes?
So Peter Minuit had to buy it again from another tribe uptown. But nobody ever hears about that second purchase.
Yes, history does sort of glide over that.
Mr. Elman, did you ever hear of the island of Muscongus?
The island of Muscongus, where is it?
It's a small island off the coast of Maine, and until recently, it remained an independent republic. though in our territorial waters, it was discovered in 1860 that Muskongus had not been included when the coast of Maine was mapped.
So what happened?
The population, 120, had their own town meeting form of government. However, in 1935, it was found necessary to have a post office, since it had become dangerous for the man who was the barber, storekeeper, postman to row to the mainland for mail. So the inhabitants swore allegiance to the United States, and the strange Republic of Muskongus passed out of existence.
Mr. McLaughlin, give us the most puzzling fact in your entire collection.
A Russian arrested in Moravia was placed before a camera for police photos, but every plate exposed was a blank. The prisoner offered to exchange the secret of his invisibility for freedom, but the offer was rejected, and the secret has never been disclosed.
That is amazing. Well, what's your favorite fact?
A milk thief in East Orange, New Jersey, wasn't satisfied with the amount of milk he was able to steal off doorsteps, so he decided to do something about it.
Well, what can you do in a case like that?
This thief left notes in empty bottles, doubling the milk order for the neighborhood.
Thank you, John B. McLaughlin. I'd like to introduce Mr. I.S. Seidman, a photographer of New York City. Mr. Seidman, what is your hobby?
I collect old almanacs.
Well, Mr. Seidman, the daily life of our forefathers was guided by the information contained in your old almanacs. Tell us about these old museum pieces which are on display here tonight, won't you?
Well, one of the most famous was Poor Richard's Almanac, published by Benjamin Franklin. In addition to the days of the year, it contained a weather forecast for each day. You know, Mr. Ellman, those weather predictions of the early almanac makers often produce strange results.
Oh, how do you mean?
An almanac publisher up in New England was very busy one day when his office boy called in and said, "Mr. Thomas, you've left out the weather prediction for July 13th. What'll I put in?" And the boss yelled, "Get out of here. Can't you see I'm busy? Put in anything." When the almanac came out, opposite July 13th appeared the following weather prediction: rain, hail, and snow.
What did the boss do?
He went into a rage. But on July 13th, according to the record, it actually did rain, hail, and snow. The next year, his almanac outsold all his competitors.
Well, when did the comic almanacs come in?
Along about 1820. Up to 1834, this was the funniest joke I can find in any of them. And this was considered hilarious humor in the old days. What does a liar do after he is dead? He lies still.
Oh, and that's the best joke in the book? What came next?
Almanacs began to print home remedies for curing what ails you. Listen to this supposed toothache cure from an almanac of 1870. A friend informed us that a roasted onion tied around the wrist will stop the worst toothache in a very few minutes. Worth trying.
Well, I hope nobody listening to this program ever tries that. Mr. Seidman, what is the one fact that stands out in your entire collection of old almanacs?
Just this, that when an old year ends, a brand new one comes along, giving everyone another chance.
Thank you, Mr. Seidman.
By the way, here's an important message from our sponsor.
I'd like to have you meet a remarkable man. His name is Fred Rossi, and he lives in Philadelphia. Mr. Rossi is 41 years old, the father of 10 children, and he's worked hard all his life to support his ever-increasing family. His home is a veritable hobbyist's paradise. Almost everything in his home is due to his many hobbies. Fred, how old were you when you started to work?
9 years old.
And how old were you when you became a master tailor?
16.
Is that what you do today?
No, I'm a woodworker by trade today.
Well, starting to work at such an early age, you didn't get much chance for a technical education, did you?
No, I didn't.
Not even a grammar school education?
No, I didn't.
Well, now, without a grammar school education or education of any sort, tell us what you do for a hobby.
Well, I have built a small village, a miniature village, for the children to come in and see.
Tell us some of the things that are in that village.
Well, I have men working on roads, men building homes, men working in coal mines, and trains going through tunnels, and automobiles going on the road.
Well, what did you make the village out of?
all out of scrap.
You didn't buy a thing?
Didn't buy a thing.
How many people come to see it?
Well, from 5,000 to 6,000 people.
In a year?
In 1 year.
Well, now, getting away from the miniature village, tell us what you've made out of boiled matches glued together.
Well, I have made a stagecoach out of boiled matches.
And here's the
on display.
How many matches are in this miniature stagecoach, which our audience just applauded so spontaneously?
8,140 matches.
Imagine that. You've made something else out of boiled matches, too, haven't you?
I have made the Santa Maria, the ship that Chris de Columbus has come across, out of boiled matches.
And all made of matches. How many?
29,800 matches.
You know, the work of Fred Rossi seems almost phenomenal. Working without education, without using the usual materials, without measurements of any kind, working absolutely freehand, as it were, he has succeeded in building a scale model of the Santa Maria that is correct in every particular. Even the sails, ropes, pulleys, flags, and everything on the boat are made of boiled matches glued together. Mr. Rossi, working and taking care of 10 children as you do, when do you find time for your hobby?
There is always time for a hobby.
Thank you, Fred Rossi. Her name is Mrs. Anna Rosengarten of the Bronx, New York. Mrs. Rosengarten, tell us why you wanted to come on.
After I heard them announce last week that you were the proud papa of a new baby boy, I thought it would be a good time to tell about my hobby.
Well, all right, here it goes. Mrs. Rosengarten, what is your hobby?
I collect baby carriages.
Well, I just collected one this week myself.
But I collect old baby carriages.
Well, ours is brand new and it's a beauty. But how would our new carriage differ from the old carriages in your collection?
Well, Alan Kent is wheeling on stage this minute the oldest baby carriage in America. It dates back to 1848.
That is different.
This one only has two wheels and a supporting rod and had to be pulled instead of pushed. In fact, it almost resembles a covered wagon.
It does, doesn't it? Well, speaking for my son, those old-time baby carriages in your collection don't look very comfortable, do they?
No, they were handmade and didn't have any springs. In fact, you can tell him from me that they had the riding comfort of a wheelbarrow.
Mrs. Rosengarten, what's the smallest baby carriage in your collection?
You could hardly call it a perambulator, but it's the basket that an Indian mother used to carry her papoose.
No, my wife wouldn't be interested in that.
Well, here's one I designed myself. It's a 6-passenger job. I'm going to give it to the first woman in the United States who gives birth to sextuplets.
I don't think I'd be interested in that, Mrs. Rosengarten. Tell us, what have you done with your hobby?
Well, my hobby brought me a husband.
A husband?
I walked into a baby carriage store one day to ask the owner a question about an old-time baby carriage. And before I knew it, I'd added him to my collection.
What else?
I'm the editor of two publications devoted to baby buggies. One is The Carriage Crier, and the other is Ye Buggy News.
Well, thank you, Mrs. Rosengarten, for lobbying for your hobby, and my new hobby, Howard Lawrence Elmer. Our next hobbyist, Alonzo C. Hall, professor of English at the Women's College of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, North Carolina. Professor, will you tell us what your hobby is?
Mr. Elvin, my hobby is collecting curious and humorous epitaphs.
Well, will you read us some of these curious and humorous epitaphs that you have found?
Gladly, here's one of them. Here lies the body of Mary Browder. She burst while drinking Sedlitz powder. Called from this world to her heavenly rest, she should have waited till it effervesced.
Are all these epitaphs in existence on tombstones today?
Yes, every one that I'm reading tonight. I've seen them personally, only the names are changed. Here's one that always amuses me. Here lies Mary Jones, wife of Thomas Jones, marble cutter. This monument was erected by her husband as a tribute to her memory and a specimen of his work. Monuments of this same style are $250.
Well, now there was an enterprising gentleman.
You'd be surprised at all the advertisements that have been put on tombstones. Listen to this one. Sacred to the memory of Thomas McCall, who died August the 18th, 1800. His widow, aged 24, lives at 25 Elm Street, has every qualification for a good wife, and yearns to be comforted.
Read that one you have about the dentist.
Stranger, approach this spot with gravity. This dentist is filling his last cavity.
Some more examples, Professor.
Beneath these stones do lie, back to back, my wife and I. When the last trumpet the air shall fill, if she gets up, I'll just lie still.
And now, Professor Hall, read us your favorite.
I don't know that I have a favorite, but here's one that's pretty close to me. It's dedicated to me, and well, one of my students wrote it. It reads, Epitaph to Professor A.C. Hall. Here lies the body of A.C. Hall. He weren't so fat, but he sure was tall. He tried his best to shock his classes, and now he lies in the tall, tall grasses. He hatched up tests too hard to master. Wave o'er his head ragweed and aster. His conscience pricked him deep and sharp, and now he twangs a golden harp.
Thank you, Alonzo C. Hall.
Seems to me it's about time to hear from our announcer.
Well, here's Dave Ellman with another of this evening's hobbyists.
Mrs. Bessie Edgecombe lives on a farm near Utica, Illinois, about 90 miles from Chicago. Her hobby is one which she can indulge to her heart's content every day. Mrs. Edgecombe, what is your hobby?
Husband and hog calling.
Well, what is the difference between calling a hog and calling a husband?
There is no difference.
You use the same call for both hogs and husbands?
Yes, but when you call a husband, you use his name.
Oh, I see. But suppose the pigs don't know the husband's name and they hear the call. What happens?
And they all come running.
Well, Mrs. Edgecombe, you've won several hog and husband calling contests at the fairs held in your vicinity. Will you tell us how these contests are conducted?
The men get up on a platform and each has a turn calling hogs. Then, when they're all through calling, the official asks, are there any women hog callers present? That's when the women get their chance.
I see. You just get up on the platform and make your call.
That's the idea.
Well, who makes the best hog callers, the men or the women?
You mean, which can be heard the furthest and longest?
Yes.
The women, of course.
Well, do the men and women ever compete against each other?
Not to my knowledge. At least, they didn't in the contest I was in. I guess the men are afraid to compete.
Afraid? Why?
Well, you know, a woman always gets in the last word. So if they hollered louder, we'd holler longer.
Mrs. Edgecombe, consider the hog calling all through. And now comes the husband calling. What do you call your husband?
You mean in a contest?
Yes, let's stick to contest.
Yes, I'd rather too. I call him by his name.
Oh, and then does he come?
It all depends on the tone of my voice.
Well, now suppose you're in good form. How far away can your calls be heard?
Oh, about a quarter of a mile.
Quarter of a mile? Well, tonight, Mrs. Edgecombe, they're going to be heard across the nation. Alan, will you step up here and become a county fair official for a few moments? Mrs. Edgecombe, since this is going coast to coast, we'll have to add an extra rule tonight. Just call your own husband.
Well, all right.
Calling all hogs and calling all husbands. Our next contestant is Mrs. Bessie Edgecombe from Utica, Illinois. Wait a minute, Miss Edgecombe, until we get the microphone turned down so that you don't knock us off the air. Okay, everything's set now. Call your hogs first. Mrs. Edgecombe, call your husband.
Thank you, Mrs. Edgecombe. Wilson lives in Rochester, New York. His official capacity is manager of the Better Business Bureau of that city. He devotes his spare time to a hobby closely aligned with his occupation and yet separate and distinct from it. Mr. Wilson, what is your hobby?
I collect worthless gadgets.
Now, what do you mean by the expression worthless gadgets?
Gadgets that have been sold to a gullible public under the pretext that they are good for something, when in reality, they are good for nothing.
You mean when measured by the standards of the Better Business Bureau?
That's it exactly. You've gone to the dentist, haven't you, and had him take an impression of your teeth?
Yes.
It's a standard practice.
And a very worthwhile one. Why?
Well, here's a gadget that was sold with the understanding that you could be your own dentist and fit yourself with false teeth.
Well, that looks like a piece of wax the dentist used.
But it isn't. It's entirely dissimilar. You're supposed to heat it, place it in your mouth, and then bite on it, thereby taking an impression of your own teeth.
Well, does it work?
This will give you an idea. In one case, the victim left the compound in his mouth too long, and it hardened. His few remaining teeth set in it, and he couldn't open his mouth.
Well, what did he do?
The emergency wagon of the fire department had to be called in to help him pry his jaws apart.
Well, what's that gadget over there that looks like a horse collar?
This is an electrical contraption that is guaranteed to cure anything that ails you. I found that it costs about $5 to make and sold, in some instances, for $65.
How did it work?
It didn't. It was about as effective as if you leaned against an electric refrigerator.
Well, mention some other gadgets in your collection.
Here's one for raising hair.
Well, that one looks like a skull cap.
That's what it is. With an electric resistance wire which generates heat when you plug it in.
Well, how does it operate?
You're supposed to wear it as long as you can stand the heat.
And does that raise your hair?
No, Dave. But if you knew how much money was raised on this device, it would raise your hair.
Probably open my eyes, too, eh?
Talking about eyes, here is a device by means of which you test your own eyes and order your glasses by mail. The authorities stepped in on this one several times, but the fraud still continues.
Well, doesn't this one work?
If there's anything wrong with your eyes, this won't show it. You put it up to your eyes, look through it, and when you see through it clearly, you order the lens indicated on the scale.
Well, what happens when you get your glasses?
You can't see through the glasses, but you can see that you've been fooled.
I see. What is the purpose of your hobby, Mr. Wilson?
Dave, I'd like to feel that through my hobby, I have been able to save thousands of people from being victimized by the men who run with your money.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Remember, when the telephone bell rings in your house next week, Hobby Lobby will be on the air. This is Dave Ellman signing his name to another session of Hobby Lobby.